This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Mopac Audio. Thanks for downloading this bonus episode of the Yuba County Five. If you haven't already, please be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you listen. It enables us to give this story and others like it the attention it deserves. I'm Shannon McGarvey. In the season one finale, I shared the discovery of a document our team found inside the Yuba County Sheriff's Department case files. This document could be a potential turning point in the investigation into the whereabouts of Gary Mathias, the only member of the Yuba County Five who is still missing. But that wasn't the only revelation we made. Recently, I sat down with Tony Wright, author of the soon-to-be-released book Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five, to talk about some of these revelations and more. A question that I get asked a lot is, when is Tony's book coming out?
I have, right now, 160 pages written, and I'm just getting into early June 1978. And what's funny, once I started the book, I started to get more connections to people or to be interviewed for the book. I'm like, where was this before I was doing all this information gathering? Like, how it seemed harder then to get people to talk. I feel like I'm like a character in a sitcom, like the guy is writing a book and it's never going to come out. It might come out one day, but
hey, it's hard work. It's hard work to write a book. It's incredibly difficult. And to call all the information between interviews and then also guide the narrative, it's incredibly challenging. But that kind of segues into why I wanted to talk to you about the case files, because before we got digitized versions, I had bits and pieces of this information. And I knew some backstory, as you did too. And then when we get the redacted digitized version, there is some information in there that, at least to me, was revelatory. There was one piece of information, a memo that was written in 2020 by the Yuba County Sheriff's Office that made a statement about the whereabouts of Gary Mathias and specifically requested that this information not be shared with the Mathias family. So that said, that was a big revelation for me getting the case files. I'd like to hear about some of your revelations, Tony Wright.
The first one I would say was the fact that there's only interviews with maybe one or two family members, depending on the family. I thought that was really odd. It's weird because if you have five missing people and with the Weir family, you had Imogen talking to the police. With the Madruga family, you had Melba Madruga talking to the police. With the Sterling family, it seems like Juanita and possibly Jim Sterling was talking to the police. The Hewitts, it was Jack Hewitt Sr. talking to the police. With the Matthias family, it comes off as Ida Clough and Bob Clough talking to the police. What surprised me was they all had siblings. None of them were interviewed. Sometimes your parents know things about you, but sometimes your siblings know a little bit more about you as a person, and they might know a little bit more about the people you're hanging out with or maybe some of the problems you're having in your life.
100%. Your siblings, for all intents and purposes, are peer-like, whereas mm-hmm. your mother and your father, they're yeah. your guardians, so they're not going to know everything that your siblings know. And beyond that, especially with the Matthias family, there was sort of this gloss. The more I got into Gary Matthias's past, the more it was like, oh, did his mom know all this? It just gave this very one-dimensional account. It seems as though there should have been more dimension to their interviews. And who knows if the Yuba County Sheriff's deputies did speak to some of these people. But I was feeling like there was, and I don't know if you felt like this, but there were times looking at the case files where I thought information was missing. What was your take on that, on like missing information?
I was talking to one of the family members about an event or something that could have happened. And I had the same feeling. I thought, why wasn't that in the report? I didn't see interviews with Gateway staff. They talked to the basketball coach, but that wasn't anything helpful. They talked to someone who worked at Gateway, but she didn't have anything to add. They didn't talk to anyone who was supervising them at a job site. They didn't talk to Ted's supervisors at the school where he was a janitor. It almost seemed like that whole part of their life was just skipped. That, no, we don't need to talk to them.
And if it was skipped, truly, if it was not included, which we don't know, we're not privy to that information, but if it was skipped, why would they have skipped it?
I think it's just probably the belief that because of their disabilities or in Gary's mental illness, that it wasn't worth it, or it was just going to be the same old, in their opinion. They're just going to hear the same thing again and again and again from these people. Well, Ted's like this, Doc Madruga's like that, Bill Sterling's like this, and this is Jackie Hewitt, and this is Gary Matthias. Well, we already heard that. Thanks. We'll see you later. I just found it odd, because if you're part of Gateway and there's all these problems at Gateway, no one's really talking, or there's not a file from Gateway.
It's interesting that in episode 7, I mentioned Janet and Zara, and I'm thinking about this now after you had said, well, there's no interviews with other family members. But they went to this person who, by the way, she didn't know him that well. I found that very interesting, that she gave this really compelling account, to me at least, that Gary Matthias has told me that he has had a dream where he disappeared with a group of people. That was a revelation for me,
right?
Because I thought that really supported one of the primary theories of the case, which is that he had some sort of episode. The medication that Gary was on, it's not conducive for playing basketball. He was on heavy sedatives. I could see him wanting to kind of go off of these heavy sedatives so that he can perform at his top abilities. And this is all conjecture, because I don't know what happened. I mean, obviously nobody does, but it seemed to kind of make sense if you were trying to support that theory. But I don't know that that's really possible, because you saw in the case files, there were some oral medications that he took daily, several times a day, but there were also medications that couldn't be taken out of his bloodstream because he received injections once a week.
I'd assume there'd be a lapse at some point. It looks like with that January incident where he gets in a fight at a party and then is creeping around the apartment complex, and they say something along the lines of, what are you doing? He says he's not worried about the people in the building because he killed them already. And that's a month before they go missing. And then what's also interesting about Gary and Matthias from looking into case files. So Gary's parents are with him at the house around somewhere around 5 and 5:30 p.m. His mom and stepdad say, hey, we're going to go out, pick up dinner. Back at the house by himself, he just gets up, walks over to Ted Weir's house. Eventually, Jack Madruga shows up, picks him up, then pick up Jackie Hewitt, and then take off because Bill Sterling was hanging out with Jack Madruga that day. So back to Gary Matthias, his parents are saying to the sheriff's department, we didn't know he went to a basketball game. We didn't know anything about it. Okay, you don't know anything about the basketball game now, but it seems like in the press to me, you knew about the basketball game. That to me was kind of frustrating because what's also just a bit interesting about Gary that day is of the group, he's wearing the heaviest coat, which could have been a personal choice. Maybe he liked this big coat, but Sterling's wearing a leather jacket. And I think Jackie or Doc was wearing that sort of light spring jacket. So those guys weren't dressed for the Plumas at all. It's not snow apparel. There's so many of these problems with the case and looking in the files. There's people they didn't talk to. There's things that are missing as far as information where you want to know, did they not go down that avenue or did they just pull it out of the case file for people like us not to see? But then you have that memo. So you saw it, I saw it. And I'm thinking, well, what's the proof?
That's what was really interesting to me is that speaking to Jack Beauchamp, speaking to Avery Blankenship, reading through the case files, none of them believed that Gary Matthias or any of the men were victims of homicide. Avery Blankenship said they went up there, they got out of their car, they perished. That's what he said to me. They just got lost. As tragic or complicated as that may be, they just got lost. And even Tom McGarry, Joseph Shones's former neighbor, said, it's really, really easy to get lost. He said, I've been lost up there. He had a home off of Four Trees Road, which is up there where the men were. So he knew these roads, he knew that area, and he got lost. And he said, all it takes is walking about 20 yards into the forest and you spin around one time, you spin around two times, and you can't tell east, west, north, south, nothing. Let's get back to some more revelations from the case file. What were some more of yours beyond that?
I didn't realize how long Bill Sterling had been in a mental institution. And to me, I don't get a clear picture of how long he stayed, if it was continuous or if it was in and out as a patient. That to me was a bit surprising, especially with his age, as the earliest age being 8, probably to age 18 or 19.
That is also another question for me. I mean, I know that when you and I first started talking, Bill Sterling was a big, like, whoa, 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 whoa. What? This is crazy. Like, why?
Right.
Because as a mother, and I know you are also a parent, and I say this with all due respect to the Sterling family and to the nuance of their situation and to the historical context of the situation. But as a mother, what instantly struck me was like, I cannot fathom sending my child away. And I have an autistic child. I cannot fathom sending him away for however long. But it's still one of those things where I'm like sort of imagining what Bill might have endured in the 60s and thinking, oh goodness, an even 8, 9, 10-year-old child being sent to a place where he presumably knows no one to live at this place for quote unquote hyperactivity and then left there for however long and stays there.
Taking a look at the case file for Bill Sterling, it's the smallest file. It's probably the least amount of information on the person we've got on the case. And so it's tough to paint a picture of Bill Sterling because we have nothing to work with as far as relatives or friends that are going to talk about him. the case file itself, I think he has the smallest file next to probably Jackie Hewitt. And the Sterlings are kind of sprinkled in here and there. So that's not helping either as far as developing a profile of Bill Sterling.
Yeah, I saw that his sister Deanna was interviewed a couple of times. I think after his remains were discovered, I remember seeing an article where she was interviewed. But prior to that, no. Another sort of revelation for me was Joseph Shones. You know, it seemed like he was so involved in the front end of this case, and then he just disappeared. And just as an aside, I found his character from a narrative perspective to be one of the most interesting, troublesome, frustrating, funny characters in this whole story. And I say that without having lived any of this. So what is your take on Joseph Shones? And again, we get a lot of your commentary on him. We have a lot of Tom McGarry's commentary. I'm laughing only because I hear Tom McGarry's voice against your voice, kind of just railing on Joseph Shones, being like, grade A bullshitter. He's this liar. And Tony, I see you as being this very straight, fair, balanced. And to hear you talk about Joseph Shones is is really funny to me.
Yeah, Shones is the eyewitness to one of the biggest disappearances in the 20th century. And he's also one of the worst people that could be at that site at that time. And it's like, gosh, this guy, he can't tell his story straight. And the newspapers keep saying he doesn't stay consistent. They were under the impression that they could hypnotize Shones and get him to remember that night. But then they also said, doctors told us not to talk to him because it might give him another heart attack. So I think Shones at some point realized that if he uses the heart attack to his advantage, he can just stay away from the case. So it looks like maybe early March, mid-March 1978, he's talking to the press. He's meeting with the family. He's helpful. He's doing what he can, and he just flat out disappears. So something I think happened, and I'm just really puzzled by it all, because it's so important to get his story, but you can't get his story. It's so weird.
So you think he met with the family for that tape where they recorded that session with him? You think that was in March of 1978?
I think it was March, but I wouldn't.
I wondered about that.
And that's another problem. The tape of Joseph Shones being interviewed is horrible in its quality.
And it was not in the case files. That was acquired through family members.
If you're the police, why didn't you record that meeting? That would have been key. And you would have him on tape.
Well, that was shocking to hear Joseph Shones's voice. I included this in episode 7. But where he kind of just snaps at Janet Madruga. She was like, oh, okay, so you got up there in a VW Bug, but when we took our old four-wheeler up there, it was really, really hard for us to even get up there. And I just want to know, like, how did you, can I finish? Whoa, dude, okay. Why are you so defensive? Two more things. I want to talk about autopsy reports. And I also want to talk about psychics. I think the role that psychics played in this case was the role of giving the families hope. They were desperate. They needed this. It's sort of an instrument of grief in my mind. You know, they needed something to keep them going. And what is your take on all the psychics involved?
Well, I think it's when you have a case like that, the door is going to open and everyone's going to want to offer help. And sometimes people are helping, and sometimes people are helping, but use that word helping with quotes around it. Their help is not that great. And with the psychics, I felt like they wanted to take advantage of a reward, over $1,000 at the time. So you got a lot of money dangling before the community, and people are going to come out and say, oh yeah, I think I saw those guys, or oh, I know something. But they really don't know anything. And with Dr. Gloria Elizabeth Daniel, I believe she's been reading the newspaper before that meeting. just the way she remembers the heart attack, but she thinks Shones is dead and he's not, which is pretty funny because she thinks Shones has passed on to the other side and is communicating with her. He's still alive. She's saying one thing like, oh, this happened. But she goes back and says something completely different like a minute later. She was just a complete waste of time.
I was surprised to see how large the psychic file was within the case file. I mean, there were drawings, there were detailed transcripts. There were a lot. And that might speak to Lance Ayers's either desperation or willingness to believe in psychics, because I've never seen a case file that had such a large collection of psychic accounts in it, like ever. The last thing I want to talk about are the autopsy findings, because one of the things that really stood out to me that I did not include in the podcast was the fact that Jack Madruga's autopsy reports, they said that he had an anterolateral break on his ribs. And I'm no doctor, but I consulted doctors about this. One, I consulted a forensic anthropologist and I said, is this like an anti-mortem pre-death injury, or is this something that would happen due to animal activity? And he said, the forensic anthropologist said, of course it's post-mortem. So the second person I spoke to was Dr. David Sainsing, who looked at the autopsy report and said that it was interesting. Anterolateral breaks in someone's ribs, that's basically upper to mid section of your ribs. And he said that typically those types of breaks are caused by high activity trauma. So a car accident, a fall, a sudden blow to the chest. And they were found 7.5 miles south of the forestry trailer, 3 miles northeast of the, as the crow flies from the Montego. So I think, well, if he's going cross country following creek beds, networks of trails, whatever, a fall seems kind of likely. Especially if there's snow on the ground or steep drops, something like maybe that was a contributing factor to his death. He had an injury outside of the cold injuries they likely sustained.
It's rugged territory. It's very rugged. And being in the pitch black of night, not seeing where you're going, and the snow covering the ground and maybe giving the illusion that it's not a steep drop or that you have enough, you have stable footing underneath. I'm surprised they all didn't fall down one of those steep drops. I mean, you walk around the Plumas, it's not flat. You're in the foothills of mountains. And there are spots where you're at 5,000 feet and you can drop to 4,000 feet. It's really, really dangerous footing up there. And I wouldn't be surprised if they fell. But then where were they? Were they walking through the foothills area in that rough terrain, or are they actually on a road going up instead of down, which is another conversation that just baffles me to no end. Seeing Jack Madruga's injuries, it had me to believe that maybe they were doing more walking through the rugged Plumas National Forest, and they misjudged a spot and Doc took a bad tumble. And that leads me to believe that when they got out of the car, they didn't go down the road. Maybe they went into the woods and eventually got back onto the road. But, and this is, like I said, a whole another conversation. Okay, did they split up? Did they get lost? Who made it to the road? Who didn't make it to the road? And with the autopsy reports, they're inconclusive.
Thank you so much. You know, you have been an indispensable source of information on this case. And you have been incredibly generous with your time, your resources, your knowledge. And I think that next time we should talk about theories and maybe get Drew Beeson in on the call.
We need this.
And have a little trifecta of theory fun. One of the things I love about Drew is that he can really get down with some of the out there theories. He's really dug into some of that. So I love that. And that represents a lot of the theories on the case. So Anyway, thank you so much, Tony Wright, author of the forthcoming book, Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five, working title.
It's going to be published by someone at some point.
Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate you taking the time today, and have a wonderful day.
This has been a Mopac Audio production. Our executive producers are Jonathan Nauzardin and Jonathan Beal. Chris Moss is supervising producer. Julian Singleton is our research and archival coordinator. And I'm Shannon McGarvey, writer and senior producer. Editing by Tanner Moore. Music by Blake Maples.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.